Today we continue our journey in the thought and writings of the Rambam. We had two classes ago offered an overview of the Rambam's biography. Last class we began to work through some of his major writings. We said that there are four major works of the Rambam that we're going to be examining. His commentary to the Mishnah, his enumeration of the mitzvot, his halakhic magnum opus, the compendium Mishneh Torah, and finally his philosophical classic, The Guide to the Perplexed, the Moreh HaNevuchim. And along with that, we're going to be examining some of his letters and other writings of the Rambam. What I'd like to do today is essentially three things. First, to go back over one point, or to complete one point with regard to his commentary to the Mishnah, which we had spent most of our time examining in the last class previously. Number two, we will examine his enumeration mitzvot, and number three, we'll offer at least an introduction to his halakhic compendium, the Mishneh Torah. So we'll start to move toward that conclusion over the next week or maybe two at most. We'll then conclude our study of the Mishneh Torah, probably 2 weeks of Mishneh Torah, the Moreh HaNevuchim, and some of the classic letters of the Rambam. So that's going to be the plan. I have up here, as we mentioned last week, that in among the various standout aspects or sections of the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah is his introduction to what is known as Perek Chelek, to the chapter in Masechet Sanhedrin, either the 10th, the penultimate, or the ultimate, the final chapter, the 11th chapter of Masechet Sanhedrin, which lists those who do and do not have a share in the world to come. The Gemarot on those Mishnayot elaborate all sorts of fantastical agadotot about the end of days, Yom HaMashiach, eschatology, and assorted related topics. And as part of that, or as commentary, as introduction to that chapter of the Gemara, or of the Mishnah, rather, the Rambam, among other things, lists his fundamental principles of faith. These are the famed 13 principles of faith. This is where the Rambam enumerates these principles. There is nowhere else in the corpus of his writings in which he explicitly counts 13 principles of faith. He does discuss principles of faith in his Halakhic Compendium, in the Mishneh Torah, in the laws of tshuva, in which the Rambam describes those who need to repent and for what they need to repent, and so on. And in that context, he lists a number of key aspects of faith, and there's some discussion as to the congruity or incongruity between that listing and the one that appears in his commentary to the Mishnah. But be that as it may, this is certainly the classic list. We mentioned, among other points, that even with regard to this same list, the Rambam actually seems to have gone back and forth a little bit, and there seems to have been some later editing. We mentioned last time the Perusha Mishnah was subject to multiple revisions. I was reading just this week that there is a scholar of the Rambam who enumerates no less than 700 different halachic conclusions or details within the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah, which he later revised and very often incorporated ultimately into his Psakim in the Mishneh Torah. So clearly the Rambam reworked this many, many times, including among them even something as key as creation, which is a key topic in the thought of the Rambam that we're going to return to when we come to his Guide to the Perplexed, the Moreh HaNevuchim. With regard to the subject of creation, the Rambam seems to have done some revision, which is pretty substantial, pretty significant kind of reworking in the writings of the Rambam. But these you have on the board are basically an overview of the Rambam's principles of faith. And now what I wanted to point out is not only to review them, but to make some methodological observations that can give us some insight not only into the thought of the Rambam, but as well into the context in which the Rambam is writing. So here you have them. And I specifically divide them up into different sections, although the Rambam does not explicitly do so. The Rambam lists them. The Rambam just lists them 1 through 13. And they include the belief in God, the belief in the unity of God, the denial of anthropomorphisms. Again, anyone who denies any of these 13 principles of faith has no share in the world to come. That's why they're listed in the introduction to the Perek of Mishnayot of Chelek, which describes the Chelek, the portion that one does or does not have in that Olam Haba, in that world le'atid la'avo. So if someone believes that God has a physical shape, physical body, corporeality, the Rambam believes that that is outright heresy. In fact, one of the major goals of the Rambam was to essentially blot out any of this foolishness, which is a really kind word to the Rambam when you've said something far harsher, but essentially this pernicious heresy that was widespread in his day, which is this primitive belief that God has a body. The Rambam thought that this is not only terribly wrong, but is horribly frankly, heretical. And the Rambam did everything in his power to push back against such absurdities. In fact, the basic theme of the first of the three major sections of the Mora Nevuchim is to reinterpret almost every single phrase in Chumash, or in Tanakh, really, that seems to refer to God's physicality, God's right arm, right, his the strength of, right, his right, when his Zeruah Netzuyah, his extended arm, his eyes, his mouth, his speech, and so on and so forth, to reinterpret these as metaphors rather than as literal descriptions, because after all, anthropomorphism is an evil, an intellectual evil to be combated. Fourth principle is that of creation. This is the one that the Rambam does some revising. There's some hot controversy about this topic in the Moreh HaNevuchim that we'll have to get back to in section 2, number 25 of the Moreh HaNevuchim. But for now, suffice it to say that there were at the time that the Rambam was writing, there were two alternative views that were commonplace with regard among philosophical circles with regard to creation. There was the view of Aristotle, who believed that God and the world are eternal and unchanging. There was no such thing as any moment or act of creation. By definition, the world is immortal. This is a key point in the Rambam, in Aristotle's thinking with regard to how change operates. Beyond the scope of our discussion, that was one view. The Platonic view, that of Aristotle's mentor and famed teacher Plato, Plato disagreed with his famed disciple on this issue, and Plato maintained that actually, although it's true that there is some immortal or everlasting hiuli, some sort of what the medieval commentators called some sort of chomer hiuli, some sort of hylic matter, which is primordial, which is forever in existence. Plato believed that actually what happened was there was some sort of form that was eternal, and out of that, God fashioned, or gods or whatever, divinity fashioned the world as we know it. So there was some sort of creation, but it was what we call in the language, again, the parlance of the Rishonim, yesh meyesh, yesh miyesh, something from something. Right, what we refer to often as vayatzar. Right? Vayatzar is to fashion or to form. So, like a potter might form clay into pottery. So too, God, according to Plato, forms the universe. The Rambam, at least in the final recension of his Pirush HaMishnah, and in what he seems to be writing in his Emorah HaNevuchim, what he writes explicitly, again, we'll come back to that. The Rambam denies both, believes these are both ultimately problematic and must be rejected. And the Rambam, in fact, concludes that no, yesh me'ayin, which is the traditional Jewish view, which is that God is, of course, everlasting, but the world is not. There was a real moment of creation. Modern Jewish thinkers might call this the Big Bang, or something like that, although that might be closer to yesh me'ayin, so it's complicated, right? But this notion of yesh me'ayin is what the Rambam formulates in at least the final version of his Pirush HaMishnah.
What's the first one called in Hebrew? Aristotle's view.
I don't know if there's a traditional Hebrew view. The Rishonim don't. I mean, it's also Yesh Miyesh, right? Except, in other words, or I should put it differently. In other words, Yesh Miyayin, right? Yesh Miyayin and Yesh Miyesh both involve some sort of moment of creation or act of creation. Mm-hmm. Aristotle just denies creation. Mm. There's just no such thing. So that would be, right? It would be Bria with a big X over it. The fair summary. Okay, five is surprising. The Rambam, and it's an I there with no intermediaries, right? The Rambam, perhaps surprising, most surprising among his list of 13, if you would have asked me, the Rambam believes that to entreat an angel to then turn to God is actually an act of kfira, is heretical. This deserves lots of discussion in its own right. So there's much of the Rambam thinking, of course, and we can't delve into everything, but this is certainly a key point that's often misunderstood, and there's some controversy about this. This, of all the 13, is probably the one that is subject to the most dispute, or certainly the most well-known dispute, or most obvious dispute in the Jewish tradition. Frankly, some of our slichot that we recited around the time of Aseret Yemei Teshuva explicitly asked the angels to daven on our behalf. If we take those literally, the words that we say in slichot are outright heresy for the Rambam. Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty intense stuff. We talk about midat harachamim, we say, Right? We turn to the characteristic of mercy and we ask it, Hapili tchinateich, right? Bring forth your or cause to fall your entreaty, right, before God, before the Almighty. Right? So in other words, we're turning to a characteristic or some angelic intermediary, intercessor to stand before the Almighty and pray on our behalf. That seems to be the invocation of an intermediary. There's even a Gemara in Sanhedrin that seems to talk about this. The Rambam later followed in this regard by the Maharal, a great early modern thinker, understands these as either incorrect texts or as simply metaphors. But that's the Rambam's insistence here. It's significant, I think, in a modern context. In other words, for the Rambam, the notion of a Hasidic Rebbe would be highly problematic. Right? The notion that I cannot turn to God and then I have to ask the tzaddik to daven for me. Not that there can't ever be a context in which I can ask a great person to daven on my behalf, necessarily, but the notion that there is a tzaddik who mediates between heaven and earth, between us and our Maker, is really problematic for the Rambam's thought. And it's encapsulated here. Even the notion of receiving a bracha in turn from the malachim is considered to be objectionable for some. So, for example, on Friday night, right? What are the four stanzas? So there's Shalom Aleichem. Okay, so right, this is we're blessing the angels there. Bo'achem l'shalom, you should come in peace. Right, the last one says Chem l'shalom, right? You should go in peace. That's all fine and good. But what about Baruchuni l'shalom? Bless it, right? Bless me and my family in peace. Right? Asking, this is a reversal, but it's sort of the opposite direction. It's the malachim are, right? God doesn't directly bless us, but rather we need his angel to do so. So there are some who, based on Ram's theology, felt that even this is objectionable. And I have friends till this day that omit Baruchuni l'shalom. And based on the practice of Vilna Gaon, who was at least reported to have omitted this section of Shalom Aleichem. There was a friend of mine, I like to make fun of that he has the shortest Shalom Aleichem anyone I've ever met, because their family practice is to say each stanza once. He omits Baruchuni L'Shalom B'Yisrael M'Kol Gaon. So by the time they start Shalom Aleichem, they're finished. So they have plenty of time for a very long Yishus Chayil. It's a very romantic Yishus Chayil with lots of time to spare. But that's with regard to the subject of intermediaries. We then turn to another list, or again, the Rambam just continues list. We come to prophecy. Number 6 and 7 is the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, the uniqueness of the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu. The Rambam insisted that, based on previous sources, without a doubt, but he enshrined in his Ikarim the notion that the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu is qualitatively different from all other prophets, and can never be superseded by other Nevi'im. This, of course, is the basis for faith, right? In other words, prophecy generally, and then particularly the uniqueness of the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, who is the recipient and the transmitter of the Torah in our tradition, clearly is axiomatic and foundational for believing in the validity and the binding divine nature of Torah, of the Aser HaDibrot, of the 613 commandments, etc. Number 8, also a very interesting and controversial one on a certain level, is the notion that the Torah was written entirely by Moshe Rabbeinu. And the point of the Rambam here is to establish again a sense of tradition, right? To entrench, right? And to root our transmission of the Torah as deeply as he can. Again, the challenge here, though, is that the Rambam declares this heresy, and yet there are psukim in the Torah, in particular the final 8 of the psukim, which we've mentioned in context of our discussions of Ibn Ezra, which are subject to some dispute. So, for example, as we've discussed, the Gemara Bava Basra on Daf Tes Vav Amud Beis cites a debate among the Tanaim as to whether the final 8 psukim of the Torah were written by Moshe or rather by Yehoshua, because after all, the final 8 psukim of the Torah, begin, Perek Lamed Daled, Pasuk, Psukim Hei through Yedbet, begin, Vayamat Sham Moshe, Ben Hashem, Moshe, the servant of God, died. So if Moshe Rabbeinu dies, so then clearly, Right? It seems quite difficult to say that that is written by Moshe himself. And yet, maybe it was written with prophecy, maybe it wasn't. But the Gemara itself has a debate, and the Rishonim debate as well what the proper codification of this machloket really is. And it's an open question, ad hayom hazeh. Right, the Rambam obviously closed the door and said, no, Moshe Rabbeinu wrote it. He wrote the whole thing. Obviously, he's trying to prop up and to, again, root deeply our tradition, but you can start to see the cracks. Ibn Ezra went further, as we've mentioned, and questioned the entirety of the 34th chapter of the Torah and other sections. That's a very controversial, hotly disputed topic, but you see where the Rambam was trying to go here. The immutability of the Torah, that it cannot change. This too, at least in regard to Yimot HaMashiach, the Gemara has some debate as to whether the mitzvot will exist in the same form and what that means. There's a lot of ambiguity about that, but the Rambam is quite insistent that even in Yimot HaMashiach, right, although there may be different stages in the unfolding of the Messianic era, maybe there will be later stages at which, clearly, for the Rambam, once we get to the stage we'll talk about later, of the immortality of the soul, right? So if it's just the soul without a body, ultimately, at the later stages of the Messianic era, it's hard to imagine that the mitzvah of tefillin will still be binding, at least in the literal sense of the term. Right? Your soul put on tefillin today is sort of hard to require in a literal sense. So at least in certain earlier state, in our current state, and in earlier stages of the Messianic era, the immortality of the Torah, and then omniscience, that God is all-knowing, reward and punishment, the coming of the Mashiach, and the revival of the dead, Tchiyat HaMeitzim, rounding it out. So these are the 13. And there are many really interesting things to say about this list. The first thing is that I've intentionally color-coded the list so as to indicate that although the Rambam himself just gives us 13, there seems to be an argument for saying that there is a structure, or sort of a coherence, to the 13 principles. Indeed, if you take a look, the Abarbanel, not the Abarbanel, Abarbanel has a different position on this. I should say, rather, Rav Yosef Albo, the author of the Sefer HaIkarim, whom maybe we mentioned at one point, I don't remember. He lives in Spain in the 15th, in the 14th, and to the 15th century. Rav Yosef Albo writes a classic work called the Sefer HaIkarim. It's divided into four volumes. The first one is an introduction to the notion of the foundations of faith. In the latter three volumes, two, three, or sections of that work, two, three, four, basically divide these into sections and tackle each one of these categories. And the Sefer HaIkarim's claim is that although ultimately he ends up agreeing with the Rambam's enumeration, these 13 principles, he said that they shouldn't be counted as 13, they should be counted as 3. And basically what they boil down to for the Sefer HaIkarim, and I think that this is a pretty straightforward reading of the Rambam, is that we have one, which is belief in something like God, right, and God's role in the world, or right? Certain core beliefs about God and how we are meant to interact with Him, something along those lines. The second principle, which is built on the foundation of the first to some degree, is with regard to revelation, with regard to Torah. Right? And then the third has to do with the category of schar v'onesh, of reward and punishment. And the way that Rav Yosef Albo at least sees this is that each one of these is essential in order for Torah to be demanded of and realistically required of us in this world. Right? If we don't believe in certain core beliefs about what God is and His role in this world, then there's nothing to talk about. If we don't have certain core beliefs about revelation and the binding nature of the Torah that was given to Moshe Rabbeinu and our status of our scripture, the immutability of the Torah, so there's nothing to talk about from the perspective of orthodoxy. There's just no conversation. Orthodoxy is a little bit of an anachronistic term. It's really a much later, it's a 19th century invention, but you'd say Torah Judaism, right, or something like that, is unimaginable. Now, the third section, I think, is the least essential to this system. It's essential more in terms of a lived reality and sort of whether or not God can realistically expect us to observe the commandments, if not for basic belief in certain kinds of consequences to our behavior. It's unrealistic, claims Sefer HaIkarim in his reading of the Rambam, for God to create a universe in which we would just be asked to do all these things, but there are no consequences for that behavior. I think as moderns, we might not sort of be as attracted to that. As for us, heaven, hell are sort of abstract philosophical notions, but most of us, and most of the kids that I've met in this school, and not just in this school, but just people who live in our world, and when I say our world, I don't just mean modern Orthodox. I mean, you know, across much of the spectrum of the Jewish community, including to the right, you just don't necessarily mean quite what they did, right, in a world in which everyone believed in quite literal, or many people lived in quite, with a very literal understanding and a very visceral sense as to what hell might be and what heaven could possibly be. So for us, these might not seem as essential, but that's how Rav Yehuda Segal sees them as sort of foundational to the structure of the Torah. There could be another reading in which you say that it's not so much that God can't demand us to keep the Torah, if not for reward and punishment, but more that a belief in a destiny, a sort of a larger, an individual destiny, a national destiny, a universal destiny, is itself an essential principle of the Torah. And that's, I'm not sure, more authentic to the view of the Rambam, but certainly more, I think, attractive to me than the former. But be that as it may, that would be the third category. There was a 19th century Jewish philosopher and pretty much a Baal Tshuva by the name of Franz Rosenzweig. Franz Rosenzweig originally started off as dissociated from traditional Judaism and certainly from Jewish practice. He was, as many at that time, on the cusp, he was a German Jew, as many in Western Europe, in particular Germany at that time, he was very seriously considering conversion to Christianity. And at the last moment, he decided he was going to go into a shul on Yom Kippurim. You'll see the relevance in just a moment. He was going to enter into a shul on Yom Kippur. That would be like his last religious act. And it was over. Yeah, that was all he would do. And then he decided, for whatever reason, this experience stirred him so much that he actually did a 180-degree turn, literally at the cusp of conversion, and turns around and decides to dedicate himself more to Judaism, to learning about Judaism. And ultimately, he learns so much, he starts to practice, he starts to wear, speaking of tefillin, he really did wear tefillin on his arm physically at some point. And as part of his journey, he was a serious philosopher, he writes a book called The Star of David. In The Star of David, which is sort of about 6 points, he starts with, in other words, right, there are 6 points to the star, he starts with the notion that each of those stars, right, that the star is really two triangles, and a triangle, the core, sort of the core, the starting point, is that there are three points along the triangle of Jewish thought. And what he means by that is to say that, philosophically speaking, there are three fundamental principles which lie at the foundation of everything that we believed in. And he termed them creation, revelation, and redemption. And then he fills in the star with sort of individual, community, universal, sort of balancing between the different concentric spheres that we believe in. But Rosenzweig, I believe, says explicitly, and it's fairly clear, right, that these correspond quite clearly to these three categories, right? So if we were to see how our fourth color, red, over here, is looking, right? So this one would be, clearly, it's a mixed. Okay, this is like what we have at night. Fundraiser, mixing colors. Right, so here the first one is clearly going to be creation, right? Although we might have said something more about the existence of God and his relationship to us. So it's an interesting term to use. We call this creation, and this would be? Revelation. And that would be clearly this is, right? This is straightforward, revelation, and this would be? Right, pretty clearly, redemption. So for him, again, like Rav Yosef Albo, like the Ikarim, he sort of distills these into three foundational categories. A few more points about these principles. The first is that the Rambam takes these extremely seriously. For the Rambam, if you don't believe in these fundamental principles, you simply don't get a share in the world to come. And the Rambam, quite frankly, has a bunch of other, how do I say this diplomatically, unfriendly things to say about someone who denies these principles. Not only that, but the Rambam writes black on white, something that's hotly controversial and strongly disputed by others. The Rambam maintains that even if one unintentionally fails to believe in these. For example, I read a pasuk and I'm led to think that actually God has a body. This is an actual example at that time. Right? Or that there's no literal coming of Mashiach or something like that or whatever it might be. Rambam says, even if I have the best of intentions, the Rambam says something that is the rough equivalent of the road to hell is paved with the best of intentions. For the Rambam, a kofer b'shogeg, this is exceedingly harsh, and again, not at all a simple matter, but the Rambam's position, quite clearly, is that a kofer b'shogeg, an accidental heretic remains a heretic nonetheless. That's his assertion. A famous story that attributes much the same position to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's grandfather, where someone was on a train with him and turned to him, and Rav Chaim basically said, essentially the same in Yiddish, that a nebuch apikoros is also an apikoros as well. Like, just because we feel badly for you doesn't mean that you're not a heretic. These are about actual principles of faith, and either you believe in them or not. Now, this is very strong, far-reaching consequences, because right? These are, for the Rambam, remember, he's listing these as essential to the world to come. For the Rambam, these are prerequisites for acceptance into the pearly gates. Or for the Rambam, there probably wouldn't be gates, and if there were, they probably wouldn't be pearly. For the Rambam, actually, he's talking about immortality of the soul, as I mentioned earlier. The Rambam's concept of eternity is highly influenced by the thought of Plato, as mediated through the Muslim philosophers with which the Rambam was so well acquainted. And essentially that view maintained that at the end of some sort of messianic era, and the Rambam there was actually part of the Maimonidean controversy, the Rambam was accused later on in life of having denied a literal Tchiyat HaMeitim. The Rambam pushed back against that, wrote a letter in his own defense entitled, now known as Igeret Tchiyat HaMeitim, which the Rambam says, no, you've misunderstood me, I do believe in literal Tchiyat HaMeitim, but that's only phase one. In other words, it's going to happen according to the Rambam, and others disagree. There are all sorts of disagreements about the world to come, as we learned last night. And maybe we'll all be surprised. That was an intelligent comment. And the Rambam's claim is that actually, the Rambam's claim is that phase one is that we will all be reborn into our own bodies. Same ones that we have now, right? I don't know, maybe we've lost a little bit of weight and looking good, I don't know. But basically the same thing. And then the Rambam says, we're going to live life again in a messianic era, which is going to be not a miraculous era fully, but one in which there won't be any external pressures. We won't have to worry about enemies who want to defeat us. We won't have to worry about supporting our family. And we'll be able to do that, which for the Rambam, every person really at their core wants to do, which is, of course, to intellectually cognize and study the essence of the divine, right, all day long. For the Rambam, there's nothing greater than this. There's no greater aspiration than to sit and, of course, to meditate and philosophize. So, at that point, we'll have that opportunity, and then we will die once again for the Rambam. So it'll be a little tzchiyat hameitim, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And at that point, all those who merit, their body will expire, and those who earn a share in the world to come, forget the pearly gates, what they will actually do is have immortality of the soul. And then they will be shorn of any bodily distractions, and they will no longer have to worry about anything along those lines, and they will just have their souls, and their souls, as not weighed down by their goof, will have the opportunity to truly connect fully with the divine without any distraction or intermediary or other responsibility that would be come along with the burdens of these things we call flesh and skin and such nonsense. So that's the Rambam's claim. Now, those who merit the world to come, that's the Rambam defines it, immortality of the soul, this Platonic notion. But there are prerequisites for that, and not everyone will have the opportunity to continue in that way. Because essentially what it is that if you have, for the Rambam, as such an intellectual elitist, if you believe in the proper beliefs, so then you're going to be so connected to the divine that you're going to have the opportunity to essentially be, you will not have the opportunity, you will to some degree be cleaving to the divine. What is the ultimate source of life? Is divinity. So therefore, those who over the course of their physically lived lifetimes cleave to God, their souls will carry on because they will be connected to the ultimate source of life. Those who are not won't continue on. So they're not going to necessarily go to some, right? For the Rambam, it's not that you go down and it's fiery. It's not even, you know, like Dante has it. It's not ice either. It's not any of those things. It's just, you're gone. This is just the end. Right? That's the end of the road. That's for the Rambam. Among others, how do you achieve that? Through intellectual understanding. What intellectual understandings? Well, these are the key prerequisites for the Rambam. If you want to have a share in the world to come, and you want to cling to God, you have to have the proper beliefs. These are the proper beliefs. And so therefore, for the Rambam, even if this is accidental, it doesn't really matter. It's not about best, and it's not about good intentions or poor intentions. It's just about having the proper beliefs. Now, probably unsurprisingly, there were many who disputed the Rambam. Although Rav Chaim Soloveitchik famously agreed, there were others who disagreed. For example, Rav Yosef Alba, I just mentioned, the Sefer HaYikarim, even though he's clearly very heavily influenced by the Rambam and very committed to the Rambam system, although he does sort of distill them into three, Rav Yosef Alba disagrees and says, Kfira B'Shogeg is not Kfira at all. He disagrees with this in the whole principle. Now, presumably he would have a different philosophical foundation for his understanding of the Ikarim, the way that they're tied to the world to come, and so he disagrees. The Ravid, Rav Avram ben David, who is going to be the Rambam's disputant par excellence, is Bal Machloket, as we'll see going forward as well. He too disputes the Rambam, and the Rambam in his Mishneh Torah, in his Halachic Compendium, cites the example of someone who believes that God has a body as someone who lacks a share in the world to come, and the Ravid says, nonsense. He says, what about those who are Gedolim V'Tovim Mimenu? Right, those who are better, right? You have greater and better than the Rambam, although there are different texts in this Hasagah, in this critique of the Ravid. But basically, he seems to be something like, there are people who are greater and better than the Rambam, right? Or maybe he means it with more humility, greater and better than himself. But either way, people who are misled by the Pashut of the Psukim. Right, and they therefore said, well, it seems to describe God as having a body, and therefore, why not believe that? In fact, this position seems to have been ascribed by contemporary scholars to a very particular rabbi by the name, not very well known outside of this context, but by the name of Rabbi Moshe Taku. And Rabbi Moshe Taku was a, I believe, Provençal scholar living in southern France, I want to say, around the time of the Ravid, who actually seems to have advocated for this position. And so the Ravid is almost coming to his defense and say, look, I might agree that the Rambam is right and that they're wrong, but still, I mean, you're going to call such a person a heretic on this basis, right? So the Rambam would say, well, I don't have anything against him. It's just his soul is going to expire, that's all. Otherwise, he's a nice guy, right? He means well, but it's unfortunate. But that's just how the cookie grumbles. So the Ravid seems to disagree as well. So there is this debate. I would say that the majority view is against the Rambam. It's hard to know for sure. I guess we'll find out. We'll find out a lot of things. But this is a fascinating point of dispute. I should mention as well that there is another explanation for the Rambam's position, but one that I was literally just discussing with someone this morning, with one of our students, and one that I take... I have a hard time understanding this position for multiple reasons, but I should mention it. In other words, another interpretation of the Rambam. And that's the interpretation that's offered by Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman. Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman was one of the Kedoshim, the martyrs in World War II. And prior to the war, he had a famed yeshiva in the town of Baranovich. He authored a number of well-known classic works in the yeshiva world, his Kovetz Shiurim, which are two volumes of commentary on the Gemara and topics that are associated with the Gemara. He has as well Kovetz He'arot, which are also analytical comments. And additionally, they've printed, I think it might have been printed posthumously, a collection of letters and writings on matters that are more hashkafic in nature, known as Kovetz Ma'amarim, collection of sayings, articles, etc. At the very beginning of what's reprinted there, he claims, or he offers an alternative interpretation of the Rambam. He says as follows. The Rambam claims that kfira b'shogeg, right, unintentional heresy, constitutes heresy nonetheless, right? Against the Raven and against Rav Yosef Abba, like Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. So explains Rav Elchanan that the Rambam's intention is as follows. The Rambam really means to say is actually there is no such thing as kfira b'shogeg. It doesn't exist. Said, after all, as religious people, we believe that if someone looks carefully enough at the universe and sees the brilliance and sees the design, right, it's inescapable for one to conclude that, of course, God is the creator. It's just, there's no other way to think about it, right? There's no other conceivable, intelligent conclusion. And therefore, says Rav Elchanan, obviously, anyone who looks out to the universe and concludes that there is no God, or even denies any of these principles of faith, obviously, that person's not a kofer b'shogeg. Clearly, what really motivated them is their sense of what we call tava, right? In other words, desire. What they're really looking to do is lead a more comfortable life. And you know what? They don't really want to be bound by the laws of the Torah, because that's unpleasant, and it's difficult, and it's hard work. And you know what? A lot of people, or there's some plenty of people out there who just say, you know what? Who needs this? It's much more comfortable to live without the rigors and the requirements of Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shemayim, of accepting the yoke in heaven. So you know what? I'm really not interested. Now, then, right, although they're initially motivated by desire for a more comfortable lifestyle, they then have to turn to a rationalization that is intellectual in nature as well, right? And they have to say, well, why don't I believe in this, right? That's not really, they didn't start with belief. They really started because they just wanted to be po-re-kol. They just wanted to live a much more comfortable and pleasant lifestyle, right? And just to get rid of the whole thing. But they need an intellectual defense, right? So what do? So they say, oh, I'm looking at the universe, and really these things are not compelling, and really I have alternative atheistic, or maybe agnostic interpretations of everything out there, but really, really, really at core, right, those are just intellectual excuses. They're just made up. So therefore, says Rav Elchanan, the reason that the Rambam claims that a kofer b'shogeg is a kofer is not for the reason that we said. It's not because even if one unintentionally denies they lack a share in the world to come because of this Platonic view with regard to the immortality of the soul. Really what it is that there is no such thing as kfira b'shogeg. They're claiming, right, or they're claiming that, right, this is really what I believe. But really, it's just an excuse. It's just an opportunity, an intellectual way for them to remove from themselves all the burdens of a halachic lifestyle. Well, that's a Rav Elchanan's claim.
But isn't anthropomorphism a different category from that, you could say?
Yeah.
I mean, from creation.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, like you said about the psukim, if you see that, you know, actually, it might be just a device that, for us to relate to something that we can't really otherwise relate
right.
to. It doesn't.
Maybe they
you know,
made a mistake.
I mean, that's.
Maybe they really mean. You're
yeah,
saying maybe it's a genuine mistake. They read the psukim.
Like, you know, exactly. It's not
correct.
In the category of looking at the world and saying,
I hear that. So far be it from me, I'm certainly not on the level of Rav Elchanan, and yet at the same time, it's extremely difficult for me to understand his approach, and that for two reasons. Number one, internally within the Rambam's own philosophy, I have a very hard time seeing this. In other words, the Rambam doesn't just say one thing and kind of leave it there. All the points in the Rambam, you see what a systematic thinker he was. I mean, this relates to his philosophy of the immortality of the soul, which relates, right? Everything is interconnected. So to say that, oh, really, the Rambam had an alternative explanation is really quite difficult for me to see. That's number one. It just doesn't fit into everything we know about the Rambam system. Second thing is that I'm not sure I'm comfortable with it. It is certainly true that there are plenty of people out there who start by being uncomfortable and then they later come to intellectual excuses. That absolutely happens, there's no question. Although even then I would say it's probably a little bit more complex, that's probably ungenerous at times. But there are real people who really, over the course of history and at this time, who have struggled and have really tried to understand and came to the conclusion that's wrong. And in particular, in this generation we have it, but I remember once hearing a line that there were two people talking and one turns the other and says, you know, they just don't make apikorsim like they used to. Like, in other words, like, the apikorsim nowadays, like, you know, tend to be maybe, you know, less intellectually rigorous and looking, you know, just sort of like, you know, that's not really where they're coming from, but, like, there used to be, there was such a thing as, like, a real apikores, which we don't quite have in the same way nowadays. I'm sure there are many contemporary atheists who would, the Dawkins of the world, who would take very serious exception to what I just said. But you know, so but what it's really not, it's not essential to our point. In other words, the point is that I do have a hard time seeing that that Rav Elchanan is right about anyone and everyone who's ever denied. Every single kofar b'shogeg is really a kofar b'mezid, in other words, intentionally, and really they're just looking for an excuse to opt out. You could say that, but I don't know, really know if that's what the Rambam had in mind, and I'm skeptical that that's really the case. So that's just an alternative explanation, but I think that the way we've seen the Rambam, I think, is the generally accepted one, certainly in the scholarly community, but beyond, well beyond that as well, in the Torah community in addition, and that's probably the basis for it. The last piece to mention is that a number of years ago, there was a publication, first of an article and then of a book, by Professor Mark Shapiro. Professor Mark Shapiro is a professor at the University of Scranton. I think he grew up, I want to say, in West Orange, New Jersey, not too far away. And Professor Shapiro is an exceedingly bright man who wrote his dissertation on the Sridei Eish, on Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the great scholar first of Germany and then of Switzerland during the middle of the 20th century. Professor Shapiro wrote an article that, controversial is a gentle way of putting it, that's really stirred the pot. And he was responding to another article in which one of the Rosh Yeshiva, actually, who was at Yeshiva University at the time, no longer at YU, but that particular author, Rosh Yeshiva, had insisted that the 13 principles of the Rambam are absolutely binding for all generations on all Jews everywhere. This is the final word in Jewish theology. And Professor Shapiro said, I would say he said respectfully, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure. It was so, I was written in quite that tone. But he said, with all respect to the Rosh Yeshiva, I think you're wrong. And essentially, his claim was that many, if not all, at least aspects of all of the Rambam's principles of faith have been subject to controversy from day one. And in fact, this became such a sort of a cause celeb of his, that he expanded this article into a full-length book on this question of whether or not the Rambam's 13 principles are the final word in Jewish theology. Garnered lots of attention. I'm just looking at my bookshelf to see if I have it here. I'm not sure that I do. It's probably at home. Yeah, I don't see it here. Something like Maimonides' 13 principles, the final word in Jewish theology. I think that something like that. I forgot. You can find it easily. It's a well-written book, and basically what he does is systematically goes one by one, and he unpacks what is the Rambam saying, what are the alternative views that are out there, and he'll sort of cite anyone and everyone who's ever raised any question about any aspect of the Rambam's 13 principles. He'll bring it into question, whether both in terms of even whether the Rambam fully believed it, but more whether or not others fully believed it. So anthropomorphism, I'll quote not only Moshe Taku, but other scholars as well who seem to have raised questions about this. And creation, is there anyone who would say, who would be more sympathetic, and even the Rambam has to the Platonic view or something like that, and is that a possibility? Intermediaries is an easy one that we've been discussing, right? The simple reading of our Slichot, the time of Asarat Mei Tshuva, is that we turn to the angels to pray on our behalf. And so on and so forth, right? Was it number 8, especially, was Torah, right? What about the Gemara Bava Basra, and then what about Ben Ezra? And then he quotes lots of others, and so on and so forth. You can immediately read the Torah. Well, the Gemara Nida has two opinions as to whether or not the Torah will be binding in Yemot HaMashiach, and so on and so forth, right? And he goes through a number of these. And number 12, he discusses with regard to Mashiach, there's a view in the Gemara that says that Mashiach already came. It's not the Christian view, but says that clearly. But says that Chizkiah was the Messianic king, or had that ability, and he discusses that. Although there, I think his argument is weaker. Anyhow, he goes through each of these, and he suggests alternatives. This has garnered lots of attention, as you can imagine. This is really, as I say, stirred the pot. And got him all sorts of trouble, which he absolutely loves. Clearly an iconoclast who thrives on people putting him outside the machana. That's just how Mark Shapiro is. That said, this is, I think, raised an important set of questions about how binding they are. And there are a number of key questions. Number one, is there a halachic process, and what is the halachic process for matters of theology? So you want to say, can I eat something or not? So we say we have certain principles that we invoke. Yachid v'rabim, if it's, right, there's a majority view, right? There are other principles, right? If it's in the Gemara, if it's codified, right, and very clearly, that will obviously be highly relevant to Shulchan Aruch, and so on and so forth. We have a system of klalei psak, of rules for psak halacha that we have developed over the generations with regards to matters of theology, whether on this list or what about other matters of theology. For example, right, certain Kabbalistic principles true. So, for example, the transmigration of the souls. Is there such a thing as a Gilgul? Right, we don't necessarily work with this frame of reference, but there were many Jewish thinkers who believed and believe today that there's some notion that we carry the souls of predecessors, whoever they may be. So talking about Mashiach, so Mashiach has the same soul as David, right, King David, and so on and so forth, etc., etc. There's actually a lot of richness. They can have lots of interesting divrei Torah and ideas about this. Well, this one's really drawn from that one. And it can even help with regard to theodicy, right? Tzadik v'ralo. In other words, well, the reason this person is punished is because actually it's the same person as someone else. And we can start to see that it can be used in creative ways to address really, really hard theological problems. So is that true or not? So how do we answer a question like that? So do you take a majority poll? That's halacha might sometimes work that way. Is there a consensus? How does that work? What if there's a consensus in one generation, and the next generation there's the opposite consensus? You know, what if, you know, living in 15th century in Germany, they thought one thing and that at large in that society. If you're living in 21st century America or Israel, you might think something else. I don't know, right? What if I'm from an Ashkenazic background where maybe some of these ideas were less prominent, and a Sephardic background, at least more recently, after Tzfat, etc., the influence of Kabbalah, maybe these things are more widely accepted. I don't know. These are really hard questions. Is there a difference between these, which have halachic consequences, because my shechita, for example, is disqualified. There's, I can't write a sefer Torah if I'm a heretic, etc. So there we apply the halachic process of majority rule. When it comes to Gilgulim, that's not part of the 13 principles of faith. There's no, it's a right belief or a wrong belief. There are no halachic consequences. And some say, well, they're already, there's no reason to talk about psak halakha, and there's no sort of halachic a guideline for how you paskin on these things. So this has become a very rich conversation. My own feeling is that I'm inclined to his larger thesis, which is that the notion that every single Jew forever must believe every single detail of these principles fully has not been the traditional belief. I say, if I would have said this 10, 15 years ago before Professor, or let's say 15 years ago, before this whole brouhaha, that probably would be shocking. I think at this point it's less shocking. So for example, take an easy one. I think number 5 is subject to dispute about intermediaries. I don't think that that's, you're outside the Machane if you would question that. I think if someone believed that the final Yipsukim of the Torah written by Rabbi Yeshua, I think if it's good enough for one, by Yehoshua, if it's good enough for one of the views among the Tanaim and some Rishonim, I think it's good enough for us. I think, you know, Yimos HaMashiach, if there might be certain changes to the Torah, I think that that's certainly a legitimate possibility, and so on and so forth. And there could be others. I probably took some easier ones just now. Like you probably pressed me on some harder ones because of some harder conversations. But that's my feeling. At the same time, it's important to stress that there are certain core principles on the Rambam's list which have not been subject to serious debate, and those are cornerstones. So Professor Shapiro stresses, well, it's not everything. That may be true, but if others, as others have pointed out as well, yes, but there are certain, right, you can point out that there are nuances or details that are disputed, but the core principles, the bedrock, right, is widely accepted. So for example, right, belief in God, unity of God, right, the Trinity from a Jewish perspective is outside, and you could point to some like Gnostic Jewish sect that lived in, not that Professor Shira quite goes as far necessarily, but right, in Second Temple Judaism, and, you know, etc. Okay, that's true, but as traditional rabbinic Judaism has emerged, that's a clear consensus, right, and so on and so forth, and other aspects of this as well. And certain basic beliefs about creation, I think you can say that. And with regard to Yimos HaMashiach, certain basic ideas about Mashiach and about Tchiyas HaMesim, etc., I think it's fair to say that that Jewish theology has been fairly consistent on the sort of the broader strokes. regards to the details, obviously there can be debates, and the devil is in the details. What is subject to dispute? What is not? And those are hard questions sometimes. And those are issues that continue to be hotly debated. But this is all part of the conversation. But I think that that's an important sort of counterbalance. That I think Professor Shapiro would agree with. It's more a question of stress. So his point is, he wants to sort of say, well, stop being so comfortable and taking just saying, right? It's a very easy thing to say. Oh, the 13 principles of faith, right? 13. But he points out it's not such a simple matter, and it's not one that is really so clear. If you want to make the other point, right, you can overplay Professor Shapiro's point. There was a book written recently by Professor Mark Kellner in Haifa. I think it was at Haifa University. Certainly was for many years. And the title of his book is Must a Jew Believe Anything? Must a Jew Believe Anything? And he kind of goes through the different positions. Rambam, the Sefer Ikarim, Abarbanel, and others as well. There are lots more views with regard to what are the principles of faith that we haven't gone through. There are some who say you can't claim that there are certain specific principles. The Abarbanel says, well, every mitzvah is foundational, because without every single mitzvah, basically changing the Torah and denying that it's the authority of Moshe Rabbeinu, so there are 613 principles. Abarbanel claims, and so there are these conversations. Professor Kellner's point is it's not such a simple matter that a Jew must believe anything. We call that orthopraxy, right? Orthopraxy, in other words, which is a common kind of thing, which is I believe in orthodox praxis, right? Practice, right? Orthopraxy, but not faith, not belief, right? So that's, right? It's an analog to an article that was written not too long ago about social orthodoxy, right? Maybe I don't. Right, this is stronger. This is maybe I don't believe in it. That might be, I don't really think about those things. That's not what keeps me in the community or it animates me. It's more of a social identification. But either way, the point that maybe there aren't principles of faith, or maybe those aren't so important, and must a Jew believe anything? So Kellner, I think, goes way too far on the other side. And with respect to Menachem Kellner, who is a tremendous scholar, the Rama has much to say and contribute. You know, to me, I think he takes the sources in the wrong direction. I think he's incorrect in that regard, and I think that there's a midpoint. So it kind of depends on your stress. But I think those are all really important things to say. One last thing for today. I have to run in just a moment. But the last point that's made is that this list of the Rambam might be incomplete at first glance. The Rambam lists 13. But there could have been one other thing that the Rambam could have listed. Which, for example, and just because we're short on time, I'll say it quickly, which the Rambam seems, for example, to omit free choice, which, right, Bechira Chafshe, with the Rav, for the Rambam in particular, is an absolutely foundational principle. Why? So there are those who claim that it's not that the Rambam omitted free choice, but that this is incorporated under the rubric of some of these. So, for example, reward and punishment is an absurdity without saying that I could have chosen to do the right thing or the wrong thing, right? It wouldn't make very much sense to punish a child, right? To punish a 3-month-old baby who causes a mischief, who clearly has no control over whether or not, right? So, no, you can't hold that baby, the infant, responsible for such activity. So obviously, reward and punishment rationally presupposes bechira chofshit, so therefore the Rambam really did include it. That could be. There are others who have suggested, though, that the fact that the Rambam omits that and maybe some other things that you would have expected him to have included, and the fact that the Rambam does include things on this list which are not entirely obvious that he needed to include them, such as no intermediaries, right, just to take an example, that maybe the Rambam is really doing something else. Not that the Rambam, God forbid, does not believe in these. He absolutely does. They are principles of faith, and everything he writes in the Perush HaMishnah clearly is what he truly believes. But could be that what the Rambam is also doing, and that this influences the count at least, or the way that he lists these principles, is he's also engaging in a polemic. And the Rambam is doing, and we've seen this previously when we discussed the Karais, we discussed how the Rambam's halachot of Shabbat are really a polemic, and maybe that's part of what's going on here as well. Because if you go down each and every one, there's room to claim that he is rejecting one or more of the above approaches. The philosophers of his day, right? The Aristotelians, in other words, right? Christians, Muslims, right? Different and Karaites, right? These four groups, right, were all heretical and problematic for the Rambam's philosophy in one way or another, even if they were important. So philosophy informs him in profound ways, but the radical views that he needs to reject as an Orthodox, or right, as a Torah Jew, need to be responded to, and so on and so forth. So he's pushing back, perhaps, against those. There's a Professor Hyman, who is the dean of Revel, which is the Jewish Studies graduate program at YU, Yeshiva University. Professor Hyman has an article in which he details these, and I think that there's a good logic to it. So belief in God, right, in the existence of God, certainly for the philosophers is a very different concept as to what constitutes God. The unity of God, right, clearly would be a polemic against what?
Christianity.
Right, yeah, against the Trinity, right? Anthropomorphism, right, it was a grotesque belief that there were many, even more traditional Jews, who believed in, and that was a common belief that he also needed to reject. Creation, as we said, is a rebuttal against the philosophers, right? Who believed, right, that against certainly Jewish Aristotelians and even the Platonists, right? The idea of intermediaries. So some would say it's a polemic against Hasidus, but which might have been if the Rambam were living at that time, but historically it doesn't quite work.
Islam.
And also in Christianity, in other words, you're praying to one part, and then, right, that has to pray, as it were, to another part of the deity, right? It gets complicated that way. All right, so you have that. Then you come to prophecy, right? The notion of prophecy. So, for Aristotelians, the notion of prophecy is theologically suspect, is perhaps problematic, and the Rambam struggles with that elsewhere as well. And the supremacy of the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, clearly pushing back against, right, both Christianity and Islam, right? This is particularly against Muhammad, but Jesus as well. That Torah was written by Moshe Rabbeinu, that it is a divine document and it is binding, right? It's certainly actually a principle that is shared by some of those, but certainly other philosophers would bring that into question. And the immutability of the Torah is a very clear response to Christianity, the notion of Brit Chadashah, etc. Right? And then you come to the last ones as well. Certainly for the philosophers, these are questionable, and who is the Messiah, right? The Mashiach, right? Clearly there's a Christian dimension there, or an anti-Christian dimension there as well. So it could be that that's just another aspect of what the Rambam is trying to do here. We are out of time, and I see that we didn't even get to talk about Sefer HaMitzvot and Mishneh Torah, etc. So we're going to have to continue with that, God willing, next time. So next time what we'll do is we will we'll come back to... we're going to complete one more thought with regard to the commentary of the Mishnah, and we're going to use that as a segue to discuss his enumeration of the mitzvot and foundational principles of the Mishnah Torah. Have a great day.